This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at the New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at the New York Times work on every day to give you clarity and perspective and, above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to the New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
From the New York Times, this is The New Washington. I'm Michael Barbaro. Today, Senator Marco Rubio.
That's how a 44-year-old son of a bartender and a maid, that's how I decide that, in fact, I too can run for president of the United States of America.
Wait. Don't worry about it, little Marco.
Gentlemen.
First of all, I don't know how he knows what I said on Univision because he doesn't speak Spanish.
I'm not interested in being politically correct. I'm interested in being correct.
I ask the American people, do not give in to the fear. Do not give in to the frustration.
Here's a good deal. Cuba has free elections. Cuba stops putting people in jail for speaking out.
If all I'll ever be is a U.S. Senator from Florida, that's a good thing, and I'll be at peace with it.
I was at the game where A.J. Dewey intercepted.
The Jets. January 83.
Yeah.
It was muddy. It was raining.
Yeah, but it was a great... I loved going there to watch.
It was a great temple for football.
Yeah.
Then there, and he's like, all the old stadiums are gone. So.
Carl, who did you talk to this week?
Senator Marco Rubio, Republican of Florida, former presidential candidate, as you might recall.
I recall it really well because I covered his presidential campaign. He was on stage for all those debates, clashing a lot with our now president, Donald Trump.
So you ran against Trump. Obviously had some moments with him. We don't need to relitigate all those. But
We can, because I think it's fundamentally misunderstood, honestly. I'm glad you asked this question. There's an enormous disconnect between the people who cover politics and the reality of a campaign. And this might be different for different people. I've never seen a boxing match where at the end of the match, the reporter asks the boxer, were you mad in the fourth round when he punched you in the face? They would look at you like you're nuts. Of course he punched me in the face. It was a boxing match. I didn't punch him before the fight, unless it was to promote it. And I'm not going to punch him after the fight, because that would be a crime. But that's what boxing is. Politics is verbal combat. And in the process of a campaign, which is a competitive environment, people are going to bump up against each other. I can tell you this without any equivocation, and you can ask the president. I guarantee you he'll confirm the same thing. Even in the midst of the what the media would describe as the ugliest moments in the campaign or the most, I never had a negative personal interaction with him in the middle of it. And the backstage before the debate, and perhaps it's because we both approached it from the same perspective, which is we were competitors. But I've never had a negative personal. I didn't know Donald Trump before this race very well. I may have met him once or twice, but I didn't know him. But I never felt like we had a negative interaction.
So Marco Rubio, actually, though he wasn't well-known nationally, was extremely well-known in Florida and had been Speaker of the House in Florida, which is a big job down there. And he was this sort of brilliant young rising star, charismatic, you know, good-looking Cuban-American from Miami.
You can't pass a court ruling that's going to keep God out of this building. You can't. Because God doesn't care about the Supreme Court of Florida. I mean, he doesn't care. He cares, but he doesn't care. You know what I mean?
And he was considered to be this conservative rebel.
Right.
He had one big problem, immigration. He had supported a bipartisan immigration proposal that Republicans didn't like, and that really haunted his campaign. You know, he had to back away from elements of that, so ran into trouble there and, you know, ran into Donald Trump, who took him on directly.
Don't worry about it,
all
little.
Right,
don't worry about it, little Marco.
Gentlemen.
Let's hear what he says. He's always calling me little Marco. And I'll admit, the guy, he's taller than me. He's like 6'2", which is why I don't understand why his hands are the size of someone who's 5'2". Have you seen his hands? They're like this. And you know what they say about men with small hands? You can't trust them. You can't trust them.
Definitely one of the most remembered parts of the debates in the campaign.
He hit my hands. Nobody has ever hit my hands. I've never heard of this one. Look at those hands. Are they small hands? And he referred to my hands. If they're small, something else must be small. I guarantee you there's no problem. I guarantee it.
So is that theater then?
It isn't theater. It's what happens when you put two people who are highly competitive in a competitive environment. And it doesn't mean you didn't feel the way you felt, but that people are capable of competing in an environment and yet not hating each other personally.
I do think that during the campaign, and this is just my view, that where Trump benefited from some of that, Rubio didn't.
In other words, people expected Donald Trump to say something that might be somewhat outrageous. They didn't expect it from Marco Rubio.
Yeah.
Well, CBS News can now project that Donald Trump has won in Florida.
By March, he had been beaten in his home state of Florida in the presidential primary, and it's just really hard to survive that going forward.
Right.
And for Marco Rubio, as we've been saying, if he wasn't able to win Florida, what do you think happens now?
Well, I think for all practical purposes, this is the end for Marco Rubio.
Now, and then he dropped out.
And he dropped out.
And while today my campaign is suspended,
and his political future was looking a little tenuous.
This far is evidence of how special America truly is.
All right, so Carl, what about Rubio now? He's back in the Senate after the presidential campaign, even though he said he was not going to return, which was a bit of a herky-jerky reversal. What kind of a role is he playing in Trump's Washington and a Congress that is a little mystified with how to deal with him?
I thought one of the really extraordinary things in this interview was where he acknowledged that as a senator running for president, maybe he didn't do his job as good as he should have. It's a really interesting moment where he said, you know,
to be frank, I also have more time. You know, when we just have more time that we perhaps didn't have the last couple of years when I ran for president. We were still doing our job but you can't be in two places at once sometimes. And so
he certainly said, not that I wasn't doing my job, but he says, you know, it's hard to be two places at once. I thought that was actually quite candid.
The reason that it does feel very much like a serious concession is that throughout the presidential campaign, that was the critique leveled against Marco Rubio, that he was missing too many votes and not really doing his job.
Mr. Trump, I'd like to ask you a policy question.
Your proposed tax cut.
That's why the people in Florida do not like him.
I guess looking back in the rearview mirror, he thinks maybe that criticism had some validity.
Yeah, you know, so now he's got some time and he's digging into some of this stuff.
We're not doing enough in that sense because this storm was responded to the way we respond to storms. And the traditional model is there's a storm and the local governments and the state governments are the first line of defense. And if they need something, the federal government fills in those unmet needs. That model isn't working here. And the reason why it doesn't work here is not because the government of Puerto Rico or the governor is doing a bad job. It's because the government itself has been a victim of the hurricane, not just the people.
So let's talk about Puerto Rico a little bit. You know, to me, you're sort of the de facto senator from Puerto Rico in some ways.
What exactly is Senator Rubio's connection to Puerto Rico?
You know, they have no real representation in Congress. They have a delegate, but a non-voting member. So, you know, that's part of the problem for Puerto Rico is that they don't, you know, have the automatic lobbying and representation. Rubio's taking that role on a little bit. He went over there himself. He's keeping an eye on that. So how do you see your role going forward in helping Puerto Rico recover here?
Well, there's three things that bind me to Puerto Rico. One is personal. I have a lot of friends and people I'm very close to that are there, or have a presence there. The priest that's baptized all my children is in Puerto Rico. And I have a lot of friends there and people we've gotten to know. It has real strong links to Florida, both through trade. The Port of Jacksonville is one of the largest exporters, importers, and it's not really an export, but transit points for products in and out of Puerto Rico. So, and then, of course, population-wise, we have a very significant number of Floridians who care deeply about what's happening in Puerto Rico. Obviously, I haven't self-appointed myself their senator, but I certainly care deeply about their issues.
Actually.
Well, you know, I'm willing to be their voice here and work on their behalf, certainly in the Republican conference.
My sense is he's been there a lot. I still actually follow him on Instagram. And as best I can tell, he has been in Puerto Rico a bunch in the last couple weeks.
You were one of the first government officials there. I mean, were you shocked? Why don't you talk a little bit about what you saw when you got there?
Well, we only went to San Juan, and San Juan was bad. So I can extrapolate from that how bad things were outside of San Juan. A lot of the information I have is from my staff that was there for a week and ventured outside of San Juan and sent back daily reports, pictures, videos, and the like. And I think the real challenges that we began to hear about was One is there was aid in Puerto Rico sitting there that was not reaching the people who needed it most. And the other is the number of people that wanted to help that couldn't get their products in. So we have spent, I would say, probably a third of our time dealing with very frustrated Floridians and Americans who want to deliver assistance to Puerto Rico but are not being allowed to land a plane. Or it's hard when somebody calls you and says, you know, I have $250,000 of medical supplies, I want to send it to Puerto Rico, and I still can't connect them with someone who can help them get it in. They get frustrated about it. And I try to explain, there's a lot of aid coming in. There's only one major airport that can accommodate entry.
He talked to you about the difficulty of aid getting to Puerto Rico. And he spoke of geographic isolation and the previous storm that was there. And that sounded a little bit like what Trump had argued about there being an ocean between the U.S. and Puerto Rico.
This is an island surrounded by water, big water, ocean water.
But Rubio does it, I guess, a little more elegantly.
Yeah, I mean, I think Marco Rubio knows a lot more about Puerto Rico than Donald Trump and doesn't have to talk about the ocean. You know, he's got staffers on the ground over there.
So was the administration responsive enough? Did they do it?
They were responsive enough. I don't have any quarrels with the response. They cared, they wanted to respond, and they responded the way the plan said they needed to respond. They did for Puerto Rico what they would have done for any of the 50 mainland states or 48 mainland states, Alaska or Hawaii. The problem is that the model that works in Florida and in Texas doesn't work as well in Puerto Rico for a lot of reasons. The geographic isolation, the pre-existing challenges.
So he's not blaming the Trump administration the way that some of the local officials in Puerto Rico are?
No. I think he's looking at it from the perspective of, you know, we just need to figure out how to do it. But he was also very explicit that since the military has jumped in there and with a bigger push, that he has seen pretty rapid improvement in the way things are going.
We'll be right back.
Hey, everyone. It's Estelle Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way the doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
So that brings us to another important topic that Rubio has been very vocal about in the same region, which is Cuba. My recollection is that Senator Rubio has always been very vocal about Cuba and the Castro regime and the right way to deal with it. His parents are from the island of Cuba, and the relationship between the U.S. and Cuba has undergone a lot of change. Can you walk us through what's been happening and his role in it?
Marco Rubio comes out of a Republican politics in Miami. This is very recent history to that generation in Miami that they were driven out of Cuba by Castro. So there's been some changing in the dynamic in Miami about Cuba and certainly in the rest of the country where people want more open relations. Well, Marco Rubio, you know, is not there. He's still part of the we really need to distance ourselves from the regime there, and while still trying to help the people who live there, the citizens. Now, he was not happy with what President Obama did. He was one of the critics.
Well, my interest in Cuba is democracy. I want the people of Cuba to have what the people of almost the entire hemisphere have, which is the right to choose their own leaders through a free and fair election. And my problem is that in the deal the president made with the Cuban government, none of that was even, no advances were made in that.
And he, you know, he talked about the recent weird, very strange, mysterious attacks on our personnel over there.
Word tonight that some American diplomats serving in Cuba are said to not only have suffered mild traumatic brain injuries, but also some with permanent hearing loss. The Foreign Service Association saying it met with 10 of those affected who were hit by the apparent sonic harassment attacks.
What does he make of those attacks? I mean, the reporting from the Times suggests that people in the State Department think that the Cuban government might have actually waged some kind of attack on American diplomats in Cuba.
Yeah, like a sonic attack. It's almost like out of a spy novel or something.
We have 22 Americans that have been severely injured in mysterious attacks in the most tightly controlled society in the Western Hemisphere and one of the most tightly monitored societies on the planet. Any American associated with the U.S. government that travels to Havana is under intense and constant surveillance from the moment you land to the moment you leave. The idea that someone who works for the U.S. government could be in Havana, be attacked, and the Cuban government not know who did it, and not just once, but on 22 separate individuals, that's ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. It's not credible.
So you think the Cuban government actually did this and is just lying about it?
I don't know if the Cuban government either did it or knows who did it.
And you know, hard to argue with it, but it's just a really mysterious incident. And I agree, the U.S. government doesn't seem to have a good handle on it.
So, but again, I wouldn't view this as anything part of our policy. This is not part of our policy debate with regards to Cuba. This is the fact of the matter that we cannot send American diplomats into places where we cannot guarantee safety for them. We can't even tell them what they need to do to protect themselves. And if we have to draw down 2/3 of our personnel in Havana, the Cubans should be required to draw down 2/3 of their personnel here. That's just a matter of reciprocity. It's not a punishment.
And at this point, what does Rubio want the U.S.-Cuba relationship to be? Sometimes it can feel like what he wants is a little impossible, which is regime change in Cuba before the relationship can get any better.
Yeah, I think that it's a difficult one. He says that what the administration's doing right now is to, you know, sort of make sure that the party that controls everything over there doesn't get the benefit of U.S. commerce, but that leaves open the door for Americans still to travel there much more freely than they did and spend their money in these businesses and shops.
Do you think the Trump policy so far going forward is the correct one?
I do.
In terms of Cuba overall, not just
this incident. Well, I think our hope in Cuba is the following, and I've laid this out. There's a lot of misreporting on it. The goal of the new policy on Cuba is to empower the Cuban individual to be economically and ultimately politically independent of the government. And that is why, on the measures the president announced, small businesses in Cuba would be unimpacted. Americans will be able to continue to travel to Cuba, including individual travel, and they will be able to stay at Airbnbs and eat at small restaurants that are owned by individual Cubans. The only thing that this policy changes is you will not be able to transact business at entities owned by GAESA, which is the Cuban military's business wing. This is designed to empower the Cuban people, not the Cuban regime. And to the proponents of the Obama opening, they kept pointing to how this had led to a growth in the Cuban private sector. Well, this policy measure is designed to further that, to in essence put the Cuban private sector in a privileged position versus the Cuban regime when it comes to American travelers and American business.
Right. So it seems like his focus is on empowering Cuban people, but somehow isolating the government.
Yeah, I think that's a best case situation, but I'm not sure you can pull that off.
Right.
But that's where his focus is right now.
Carl, it would be hard not to talk right now about gun control. And I remember when Rubio ran for president, he just happened to casually mention that he is a gun owner and he has been somebody who champions the Second Amendment. How is he approaching a post-Las Vegas mass shooting world where there suddenly seems to be a conversation in the Republican Party that hadn't been happening for a really long time about giving an inch or so on a couple of things related to gun control?
I mean, the whole gun issue and mass shootings, very prominent for Marco Rubio. He grew up in Las Vegas. He lived part of the time out
there.
That's
right.
How did this personally affect you?
Well, I have a huge family. I have more family in Las Vegas than I do in Miami or in Florida. So you obviously always worry that perhaps some member of your family might have been there. It's a big crowd, and that was not the case, fortunately. We don't know enough. I think we're all still waiting to learn more about what would motivate someone to do this.
He seems open to the idea of restricting the special addition to the assault rifle that made it in Vegas to shoot almost like an automatic weapon.
The bump stock.
Yeah.
So a lot of people don't know much about bump stock. It is a way to alter the way a gun works, yeah, to turn it into something that would otherwise
and
be banned under federal law unless you have the right permit. So I'm interested in learning more about it. Suffice it to say that you know, it's something I'm interested in learning more about, because I do think, depending on what we learn, that it might have had an impact, perhaps not in the attack, but it's certainly in the number of people harmed in an attack such as this. So it goes back to what I've always said. If there is a change in law that does two things, respects the Second Amendment constitutional right of Americans, but also prevents these attacks and keeps dangerous guns out of the hands of dangerous people and criminals, I'd be open to it. The challenges in the past is virtually every measure that's been proposed in response to these horrible tragedies, the changes they proposed would not have prevented those attacks. They would not have. If there is something in federal law that could have prevented or mitigated this attack, we're always open to that. We've always said that.
Like a lot of Republicans in the Senate right now, he seems open to the idea that they could do something, which is a big change from the past. But he's not committing to anything, right? And, you know, Florida Republican, you're going to be a strong gun rights supporter. It's been a bedrock issue in that state in Republican politics for a long time.
Carl, I want to end where we started in a way, which is that it feels like Rubio is in this very delicate position of being somebody who can oppose Trump and does oppose him, but does it diplomatically and seems to fall in line. To some people, that has been a disappointment. They expected him to be a more outspoken critic of the president. To others, it's just completely practical politics in line with the rest of his career. What do you see his evolution as, and is it any kind of model for people in the party?
Yeah, it's actually a pretty good model in some ways, because he has established that he can, you know, challenge the president and, you know, push back on some things, but still have a working relationship with Trump and, you know, be somebody that can go to the White House. That's not a bad thing. You know, we haven't talked, but Marco Rubio is on the Senate Intelligence Committee investigating the Russian activities in the election and whether there's any collusion with the Trump administration.
Right.
And we'll see how he plays that investigation, you know, because the president and some of his supporters have been pushing back that, you know, maybe it's time for these investigations to wrap up. Well, the Senate Intelligence Committee doesn't seem ready to wrap up. You know, he is trying to do a couple of things at once. He wants to get down in the substance of issues and be a good senator, but he still wants to play a prominent role in the party, in Washington, and, you know, keep his high visibility for, you know, maybe a future something else.
Carl, thank you very much.
Michael, thank you.
The New Washington is produced by Michael Simon Johnson and Michaela Bouchard. Brad Fisher is our engineer. Lisa Tobin is our executive producer. Samantha Hennig is our editorial director. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Lansford of Wonderly. That's it for The New Washington. See you back here next weekend.